Welcome, Professor Sipiwo Mahala. Thank you for giving us your time to talk about literature today. Listeners, Professor Sipiwo Mahala is the chair of the Sunday Times Literary Awards and an associate professor in the Department of English at the University of Johannesburg. He is also an acclaimed writer in his own right. With this podcast, I aim to explore literary spaces in a broad sense. That means not only speaking to writers or readers, but also to the people who shape how literature is recognized and valued. So when I realized Sipiwo Mahala oversees the awarding of this year's South African Fiction Prize, I knew I wanted to speak to him. I was thrilled when he agreed. Thrilled and honored. I'm very curious about how the judging and selection process works. And one of the questions in my mind is, what should a South African Literary Prize winner reveal or achieve in its text? I think our listeners will find this fascinating. But before we go there, I'd like to share that I have followed Sipiwo's published trail. I've read two short story collections, African Delights and his latest, The Missing Pages, as well as his recent biography of drum journalist Ken Temba, Ken Temba, The Making and Breaking of the Intellectual Tsotsi. I would love to talk to you about your stories. But before we do, I'd like to propose a small experiment. In your biography, you open chapter 13, which is called No Ordinary Storyteller, with a quote from Muksi Nkondo, and I'd like to read it. Muksi Nkondo says, "There's a theory that was associated with T.S. Eliot, where he says the mind that creates is different from the man who suffers. So T.S. Eliot made a distinction between the experience of a writer and what he writes about. Ken Temba collapsed this distinction. The man who suffers and the mind that creates is one and the same thing. In literary circles, there's often a rough divide between those who believe the writer inevitably reveals himself in the text and those who believe the text is an entirely separate voice. While reading your work, I caught myself filling in ideas about the writer, about you, based on those stories. Maybe it's because I read your books consecutively. Or maybe your writing invites that kind of imaginative projection with me. I'm not sure. So here's my experiment. I have written down in simple words a loose sketch, motivations of the writer I imagined while reading your work. It includes questions too. I'd like to read it to you and ask whether this picture resonates with you, or maybe not at all. Are you open to that?
Yes, I am. And thanks for having me here. This is getting exciting before you ask your first question.
Yes. So I'm also excited what you will say. Okay, here goes. What I see is a writer whose mind works with visuals and images. You picture people, landscapes, and animals in your mind. Horses are a favorite. You can imagine what happened to them. You are not afraid to share with an audience what ugly things can occur when people live their lives. A tool for you to do this is humor. You use it to give the reader the illusion of a pleasant story, yet there is this layer below it of criticism of us humans and our behaviors that I could not miss. At some point in your life, you came into contact with the stories of drum magazine journalist Ken Temba, who lived and worked in Sophiatown, which was a multiracial suburb in Johannesburg. You were captured by his story, so much so that you wrote a thesis about his life and published his biography. How you came in touch with these stories, I don't know. You also used one of his stories called The Suit for your own version. A rewrite, reimagination of what could have happened in modern times, intertextuality is a main theme of your work. Texts are answers to what was written in the past or happened in the past. But it is the creation of the new from the old that is important to you. It is a way to keep alive valuable artworks made in the past. I sense Ken Temba is a hero for you, despite his alcoholism, because living and working during apartheid was a continuous stream of derogatory and humiliating moments, to say the least. Apartheid created boundaries that were impossible for any human to flourish. Do you believe the consequences of apartheid are still overlooked? You, like Ken Temba, are fascinated and inspired by Shakespeare. You have read widely from him, and I have the feeling you believe his works are uniquely human and of all times. You write for the future, and hope is a part of that. How is this for you?
Wow, it's a mouthful.
Yes.
thanks again. And I'm really impressed with your observations. And you've raised a number of issues, some of which I might miss. But quite fascinatingly, you mentioned essentially my rural background and fascination with animals. And there I can say I'm guilty as charged. I come from a small town in the Eastern Cape called Makanda, previously known as Grahamstown. And I partly grew up in Alice Edigeni, which is the villages in part of what was Sisgai.
Yes.
So I naturally, one interacts a lot with animals, and I just came back from Makanda this weekend. I mean, yesterday, I attended a funeral on Saturday and in Makanda, and immediately after the funeral, in fact, I didn't even go to the graveyard, to the cemetery. I drove straight to Berlin. Berlin is a small town. I was attending what is called Berlin November, which is a horse racing event in a rural setup.
Oh, yeah.
it was the first time that I actually attended it. It's something that I always wanted to do, because I'm fascinated by horses in general. I've never been on horseback.
So, yeah, I wondered about it. I think, yeah, your story really convey your love for horses.
Yes.
So I wondered about it, and that's why I thought I'll tell you that, yeah, I envisioned it.
Yeah.
This love.
Yeah. So riding a horse is in my bucket list. Something that I want to do before the end of this year.
Yeah.
But generally just admiring them, watching them. When I went to Berlin November on Saturday, many people were more fascinated with the party and the fun things that they do after. But I was more preoccupied with the horses, just watching them.
Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm. And also watching them do the race.
Yes.
So for me, that is also, it's in your short collection, The Missing Pages. And it is actually one of my favorite stories. It's called
The Old Man's Horse.
Yes.
Now that you mention it, I realize that I have three stories that have horses as characters. You have The Missing Pages itself, you have Hunger, and The Old Man's Horse.
Yeah. Yep. So you say, as a reader, I was sort of right to pick that up.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
It's the first time that any critic or any reader has picked that up.
Right? Okay.
Or at least communicated that to me.
Okay. Now, well, I'm honored by that. Also, you've called your latest short story collection The Missing Pages. For me, one of the things that you convey in this story, The Old Man's Horse, is a part of, and you've just retold it as well, a part that I think as somebody who lives in South Africa, but is not in touch with many aspects of South African life, that I miss. So for me to hear you tell me about these things and what happens to horses and the races was very, what is the word, enriching. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, look, we often talk about our past, and you sometimes you'd swear that people had to deal with apartheid, you know, all the time. Or when we tell our stories, we tell about lives in the cities, you know, whereas the vast majority of the population of this country lives in the rural areas. And we need to observe, you know, how life, you know, is like in these areas. And yeah, I've always known about the various horse races, for instance, in the villages. It was the first time that this weekend that I actually attended a formal horse racing event, and it was quite fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I made a few questions in this piece I made green to go back to you. I'm curious because how did you came in touch with the stories of Kentemba? Could you share that with us?
Yeah, well, that's another fascinating story in the sense that I read, like most people, I read The Suit.
You read? Yes, The Suit.
The Suit when I was still in high school. And it was not a prescribed story. I just came across it because a neighbor who was studying at university had a copy. And apparently it stayed with me. And subconsciously, when I started writing, I wrote a story called Mbumi's Assignment, and published it in 2001. And I got so excited after publishing my first two stories in 2001, I resigned from my job, and I saw myself as a writer already. And I went to Vets to do masters. And part of that was to do a course in creative writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had to present our work in class. So I presented Mbumi's Assignment. And the feedback was that it reminded them of Kentemba's The Suit. At that moment, I did not have a clear recollection of what The Suit is like, you know. And I took offense somewhat, because I thought they meant I had plagiarized The Suit.
Yeah.
So I went back to The Suit, reread it several times to try and understand the link. And I later realized that it was, in fact, a compliment. You know, yes. In my story, there is a man, or rather a woman who's married to this man, finds an earring in her bedroom.
Yes.
And she does not know who it belongs to. She asks the husband. The husband says, "It is my earring." And then the wife says, "Well, if it is your earring, put it on." And then she reminds him when he has to go to work, and he's a school principal, to put on the earring.
Yes.
And then everybody starts laughing at him, you know. So this is the link with The Suit, because in The Suit, Matilda is made to walk around with a suit.
Yes.
Which belonged to the man that she had an adulterous relationship with.
Yeah.
So that's the connection.
Yeah.
You know, but after reading The Suit so many times, I realized that there's a story that is not told, that if The Suit is about adultery.
Yes.
What happened to the man, the third man in this relationship? You know, what happened to that man that jumped out the window? Because that's the last we hear of him. So
yes.
I began to reimagine now life from his perspective, to say what happened after he ran away, you know. Hence, if he became the central figure now in my story, The Suit continued. So after having written that story in 2002, so many critics started drawing parallels between my work and Kentemba's work. You know, and at that moment, people thought I knew much about Kentemba, and in fact, I didn't, you know, because there was barely anything about him as a person.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate that I had interactions with people who had interactions with Kentemba back in the 50s. I worked very closely with Brawili Kiorapezi Khotitsile, Louis Nkosi, and Eskia Mphahlele.
Yeah.
And they all used to talk about Kentemba. And it was after the passing of Louis Nkosi in 2009 that I realized that this generation is being phased out and they are dying with all these stories. From that point, I started doing interviews with some of these people who knew Kentemba. I interviewed Nadine Godima. I interviewed Don Matera, Joe Tlolwe, Jubi Mayet, many of them, actually over 20 interviews.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was not even thinking about starting. It was Mbulelo Mzamane who suggested to me that, look, you already know so much about Kentemba and there's nothing much about him out there. So why don't you just do your PhD on Kentemba? Yeah. And Mzamane was himself a writer and he was the vice chancellor of Fort Hare when I was a student there. So we had maintained that relationship. And throughout, I mean, for 10 years, he had been telling me to do PhD. But what was different now in 2013, he gave me a topic. He said, do it on Kentemba. And 2014, I registered and the rest is history.
No, thank you for writing it. Thank you also for telling this. So you first read the story in the suit, then you wrote the story yourself. Then people told you, this reminds us of Kentemba. And then after first thinking, hey, almost feeling insulted maybe, you realize this is a compliment. And then looking for more information about Kentemba, realizing a lot was missing.
Absolutely.
Let's start and investigate that and fill it in. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. For me also, because I also believe if I look, sometimes I want to look at African literature or habit or tradition, and then it's sometimes very difficult to find more. And now we have this biography. And I've learned a lot, also how Sophia Town worked, other people that lived there, and Drum Magazine has come alive to me. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What I noticed also is that when we spoke about Kentemba, we often, you know, spoke about him as part of a collective, you know, the drum generation.
Yeah.
Yes, he was an integral part of the generation. However, individually, they had their own characteristics. They had, you know, unique personalities. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So because of this, more people have found a richer life, actually. The persons have become richer.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I've enriched.
I think they did. So you just also spoke about you responding to Kentemba's story, The Suit. I mentioned intertextuality here. One of the questions that I've sent you also is, what is intertextuality for you? And specifically this story, The Suit, it fascinates me. What is it you think that inspires so many people to rewrite it or reimagine it? Because you're not the only one. There's two other persons. Sukima Warner wrote a story inspired by The Suit. And I don't know her first name, but last name is Saba.
Well, first of all, intertextuality, I see it as the acknowledgement of the fact that there are one text influenced the other. You know, we are influenced one way or the other by the books we read.
Yes.
You know, So, as I say, in 2002, I wrote this book. I mean, this story, The Suit Continued, which continued the journey of the character that is Pasha is mentioned in the suit, but whose life is not explored.
Yes.
So I wrote The Suit Continued from his perspective. And then Zuge Savrana, after reading The Suit Continued, she identified another gap to say you have the suit, which is about adultery, essentially. And so far, the voices that are dominant are those of men, two men, Philemon and Terence.
Yes.
Yeah. But the woman who is central to this love triangle, her voice is silenced. So, based on that, another story emerged, which is The Dress That Fed the Suit. So the dress, in other words, the suit represents masculinity. So now, in representing the woman in this love triangle, we have the dress.
Yes.
And I think I found it quite fascinating that she came up with a story in that sense. And years later, this was 2007 when Zuge Savrana wrote the story. And then in 2011, Makosazana Xaba published her short story collection called Running and Other Stories.
Yeah.
Which included two stories, The Suit Continued, The Other Side, and Behind the Suit, I think. Yeah. So she included those two stories where she introduced now the queer element in this The Suit series. And yeah, which was also quite fascinating because I'd never seen any story that has been explored from so many angles and has been adapted as many times as Kentema's The Suit. The story was first adapted by Barney Simon and Motobi Mtlwatse as a play in 2003, sorry, in 1993.
Yeah. So I don't know that play history that well, but I am fascinated by it. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, it also became into a play.
Yeah. Well, the first adaptation actually was the play in 1993. And then that play was so successful that, the French director, Peter Brook, adapted it as a musical.
Yeah.
And it traveled the world. I mean, so far, it's been performed in about 30 countries around the world.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, so it's been made a film, a short film.
Yeah. So, but what is it then in his story you think that makes it so inspiring to others? Do you have an idea?
Well, I have some ideas. From the point of view of a teacher now.
Yeah.
I teach The Suit and one of the things that fascinate me about it is that it's got all the elements that you'd want to see in a short story.
Yes.
Right. It's got, you know.
What are those elements then? Yes. I would love to be taught.
Yeah. Well, there are many, but I can talk, for instance, about, you know, the immediacy.
Yeah.
Of the actions.
Yes.
The fact that it has one central theme, the characters are limited, the imagery in general is quite amazing. I think for me, it's the fact that, it is not really dependent on the fact that it's a love story. All right.
Yeah.
Love stories have been told over and over again.
And also adultery stories.
Yes. You know, they've been told over and over again.
Yeah.
But what makes this one so enduring is the fact that one, it's relatable across generations. Two, every character that you find there is used to the maximum.
Can you repeat that? I could not hear what you said.
Oh, okay. I'm saying is, first of all, the suit deals with one central theme.
Yes.
The characters are limited.
Yes.
But each and every character that you find in the story is used to the maximum.
Yes.
Including a minor character, for instance, like the man that jumped out the window.
Yes.
Even though his involvement in the story is limited, but it's very important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
The same as there's the man that's called Mapigela. His appearance in the story is limited.
Yeah.
But it makes the difference, because that's where the pace of the story changes, because he's the one who tells Philemon that when they meet at the bus stop, that there's a young man visiting your wife.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing changes. That's the last time we see him in the story. But his presence makes such a huge difference in the story.
Yeah.
Yep. So those are some of the elements that make the suit as a story work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think what Ken Temba did, and what you also do, is those elements, like the man jumping out from the window, it is, you can envision it, you see the image. So that is, I think, why it's very compelling. So it stays in your mind. And then the other thing that I also thought is, it's imagining. So how did Ken Temba think of the suit being used in the dining room, and she had to walk with him? How did he think of it? That is like imagination, I think. So I wonder about that. It's like, how do you think of that? I would have never have thought of something like that. Do you agree? Or
I would never have thought of it either. But you know, elsewhere I write, for instance, about how just a piece of cloth,
yes,
can be an inspiration for a story.
Yeah.
I make an example about my own grandmother, who used to make pillows out of sacks.
Yes.
Just, you know, a sack of maize when it's empty. So what she'll do, she'll fill it up with old clothes.
Yeah.
And then stitch it. And we use that as a pillow.
Yeah.
But the trouble was, when it is soiled, when it is dirty, she has to wash that sack.
Yeah.
So she had to unstitch it and then take out the pieces of cloth that she has stuffed in the pillow. All right. When she takes out each piece, she will tell you a story about it.
Oh, yeah.
You say, you see, this piece of cloth is from the blouse that I was wearing when your grandfather spotted me amongst all other girls. And she goes on. I mean, she was just preparing to wash a pillow.
Yeah.
But that becomes a story about the family tree, how she met my grandmother, sorry, my grandfather, and a story comes out of that small piece of cloth.
So then it's also like looking at objects and then seeing the story around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In other words, you don't have to look for something sensational.
Yeah.
Even a non-living object, even one that cannot speak, like a horse.
Yeah.
An animal like a horse
can
actually, you can come up with a story around it. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for this. Then the other thing that I also think is fascinating with this is the way, and I'm interested in it, how it works. The way the humor, so it sort of is funny, and it's at the same time cruel. Do you think in these stories those two are intertwined, and that makes it so compelling?
Yeah, it's usually said humor and, you know, lightens up the gloomiest of stories.
Yeah,
and I believe that. I mean, it's from human experience. We laugh even at times of bereavement.
Yeah.
So I, you know, whenever I can, I do inject a bit of humor in my storytelling, because the whole idea is to ensure that the reader feels compelled, is captivated by the words, You know, you would remember that a story is just words on a piece of paper. So your duty as the writer is to paint pictures out of those words and ensure that with those pictures, you are able to grab the attention of the reader until the end of the story.
And the fascinating for me is that within my book club, I'm known as the one who doesn't see the humor in some very humorous stories like The Master and the Margarita. So it's dark humor, and then I don't get it. And I also tell them, for me, it's not funny at all. So, but I read your stories, and yeah, I did. I smiled. I found myself like smiling for sentences, and, but still there's that cruel thing or horrible thing going on. And then, yeah, so I wondered also within myself, there's this humor and it's cruel. And then with your stories, I did pick it up. So I'm a little bit proud of myself.
Thank you.
So what I read to you earlier, I'd like to ask you, do you believe a text is a direct representation of its writer?
I believe not. I believe it is a reflection of aspects of a writer.
Yes.
Yeah. In other words, you know, I've written about horses, but I've never been on a horseback.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
So they are my preoccupation.
Yes.
But it does not necessarily mean I've been through that experience.
Yeah.
So it reflects my headspace. It reflects what my preoccupations are, what my interests are, but it's not always a direct reflection of who I am.
Yes.
Yep.
I understand. For me, it's also that the writer can write a story that doesn't reflect his ideas. But for me, it's also always there to then know the writer did make a decision to write that story. So in that sense, it is somehow always linked to the writer.
Yes, it is linked. What I'm trying to say is, the mistake is to assume that the protagonist is the writer.
Yes.
It's not always the case.
No, I agree.
Yeah. The story, you might find the elements of a writer, you know, dispersed across different characters.
Yes.
But one thing for sure, you are writing about a particular subject because you are interested in it. So that's why I'm saying it shows your preoccupation.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Also, in your opinion, for a writer of literature, what holds greater importance, the skillful crafting of language or the creation of imaginative, invented possibilities of human encounters?
Well, I think all of this combined because
yes.
I think the approach for me personally is to ensure that, you know, using the language, I use it in such a way that it is easily accessible to the reader. I don't write to show my superiority over the reader. You know, my interest is for my work to be easily accessible. And as, you know, it's part of the skill that I was talking about, that you must, your imagery has to be so arresting, so captivating that when the reader starts reading, they don't feel like, you know, putting the book aside, because we must recognize the fact that we're competing when we write, we're competing with several mediums. That person could be cooking, could be listening to the radio, could be watching TV, watching soapy or anything like that. So when you write, you are saying, leave all of these things, attend to me.
Yeah.
You know. So you must have a compelling reason to take that person away from TV and let them read your text.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. In your biography of Ken Temba, you mentioned that there's an element of intellectual apathy among researchers who accept his alcoholism without due consideration of the factors that led to it. This reminds me of Malcolm Gladwell's discussion of coupling in his book Talking to Strangers. He explains that coupling is the idea that human behavior is tightly linked to very specific circumstances and conditions. Ken Temba was denied a teacher's certificate. He did not get an editor's salary. He was not allowed to be published. To simply say that he was an alcoholic emphasizes the behavioral response to an environment, while overlooking what he did do, writing strong literary short stories, sharp journalistic works, and teaching. Is this what you point to in the quoted line, that judging him simply as an alcoholic misses the extraordinary output he achieved while living in such a hard environment?
Yeah, my interest as a writer, as a storyteller, is to, and even as a critic for that matter, is to say, how do we become what we become?
How do we become what we become?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, so it's easy to say he is a madman.
Yes.
You know, but what drove them to that point? You know, so with Ken Temba, I always found it intriguing that he carried the label for a very long time of having been a drunkard.
Yeah.
And from a scholarly point of view, there was no investigation to see how did he become that drunkard if he was a drunkard, you know. And as you may have seen in the biography, that what appears is that he did not drink before joining drum.
Yeah.
So it is a number of factors that exposed him to drinking. That first of all, the culture of drinking was encouraged at drum. Secondly, Louis Ngosi, I was fortunate to talk to him, and his motivation was that they were exposed to so much difficulty, you know, reporting about what was happening in the communities, seeing cracked skulls of children, and these are people that they live with. They were more connected to these people. So he says, this is Ngosi, that after, you know, a day of reporting, you needed a drink to wipe away those images, you know. That's one of the factors that we never thought about, the traumas that these journalists go through. How do they overcome them?
Yeah.
Surely there was no therapy, psychotherapy of any sort. That is one. Two, when I looked at the fact that Ken Temba was not happy with teaching because he was not paid as a teacher, and when he called to drum, he was not paid accordingly, and the fact that several editors arrived after him, white editor, he was the associate editor, and drum always employed a white editor from England, who had no experience of editing in a magazine of that kind, no experience of the township. And it was Ken Temba's responsibility to induct them, to show them how to run the magazine, you know. So that also might have affected him.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep.
I think the circumstances that he had to feel like a worthy human were almost not there.
Absolutely.
So his worthiness was kept very small. So when words of alcoholism are being used, people tend to just go down that tunnel road. It's like a tunnel, and then that alcoholism becomes the person.
Absolutely.
While I think we need to be careful of that and use other words to describe him, because those words are so hectic in our society.
It's easy to label.
Yes.
It's easy to label people. And
and when we do that, then we're not looking at the other things that he did. And the things that he did do were actually amazing. He was a journalist. He did the groundwork. He did writing. teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. The work that he did has outlived him.
Yeah.
Ken Temba died in 1967.
Yeah.
And today we still celebrating his work.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a far longer lasting legacy.
Yeah.
Than the fact that he actually drank.
Yeah. So yeah, and I've now read the suit by him, and I understand why it inspires so many people. Do you know his other works? They are not readily available, are they? So he has a short story collection also?
Yeah, he has a short story collection. When he died, first of all, Ken Temba was banned from South Africa.
Yes.
He could not be quoted, and he died in exile. So that separated him from his people. And his first book was published about 15 years after his passing.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, which is the short story is The Will to Die. That's the first collection of short stories. But I've also discovered some short stories that he wrote using pseudonyms.
Yeah.
And others that were not published at all, you know. So yeah, he wrote material that unfortunately was not recognized as his own.
Yeah. And are you now still working with that to collect those maybe?
Not necessarily, no, not to publish per se. Yeah. I'm just, writing academic papers based on those.
Yeah.
Like one of the episodes of his life, for instance, is his work as the editor of Africa Magazine.
Yeah.
Which again is not very well known and is even difficult to find in the archives. So earlier this year, I published an academic article about Africa Magazine and its archive.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Is there anything you would like to ask? I have two more questions, but that's not about your, that's more the broader sense. Do you have something to ask me or something to say?
Yeah, not necessarily, but I presume you speak Dutch, right?
Sorry?
I presume you speak Dutch.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you thought about taking some short stories and translate them to Dutch? Some South African short stories?
Your short stories.
Anybody's
short stories. Mm-hmm. I've never seen myself as a translator.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you've planted an idea. I think my skill doesn't really lie in language. And I think if you're a translator, you need to be very skilled in language, in structure, in grammar. Do I make sense?
Yes, you do. But I don't believe you need skill in that only. Your level of imagination is also very important. But in any case, I'm thinking here that are there, for instance, stories that you've read like 10 of my stories or more?
Mm-hmm.
Are there two or three stories that you feel can be translated table into Dutch? Is there someone who could do that? You've read some of Ken Temba's stories. Do you think a Dutch audience would enjoy that kind of a story or would relate in any way? Yeah.
That's a little bit of a difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
I find it difficult to sometimes find interest from the Netherlands towards what is happening here. But the stories itself are definitely worth and should inspire people to think about what happens here. Also, I think because besides what you do here is your specific South African context, which comes up in all of your stories. I also think that it's not only South African, it actually also speaks to a human level that is around the world. The other favorite story of mine that you wrote is The Asylum, where a father and a son goes to visit the mother who has been admitted to a psychiatric hospital. And they want to ask the people, the staff there, to bring her home for Christmas. And then there's a whole discussion going on, which has a lot to do about apartheid, about white people in power and black people who have to listen. But I also sensed a level of bureaucratic institution having that, not being open, no flexibility to rules. And that really spoke to me, and your stories do that too. So in that sense, I would also say, yes, these stories, and I'm sure Kantemba's stories too, definitely speak to other countries as well.
Yeah, I try to tell human stories.
Yes.
Stories that any human anywhere in the world could relate to. That story in particular, The Asylum, it's one of the stories that have stayed with me for the longest time. And I finally had an opportunity to write it in January this year, by the way, because it's a story based on lived experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lost my mother 39 years ago already.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So, well, I've lived without her for that long. So one of my memories, because she had a mental illness, was when we visited her, in the institution, and it was just before Christmas, and we couldn't, I mean, due to the rules, we're not allowed to take her home. Yeah, the way the story ends is not how she died, by the way.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah, and quite interestingly, I conceived the story as a play. As a stage play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I wondered about that.
Yeah, yeah, but I wrote it first time as the short story, and then I later wrote it as a play, which, yeah, I hope will be staged next year.
Yeah, so why it spoke also to me, because my father has had quite severe periods of depression. So when I was 11, he was also admitted to a psychiatric hospital. And I remember that I went there to visit as a child. And then I saw somebody else, which really scared me as a kid, who was a patient there. And then I didn't want to visit my father. So my mother and my brother and sister went in, and I stayed outside the hospital and I waited till we could go home. So for me, what you did with this story is not only talking about mental health, but also about you draw us into the people who are around it, which is something close to my heart, because I think, yes, we have to care for the people who have a mental illness, but its web is bigger. It's like the people who surround the family, the friends, they are also affected.
Absolutely.
It's sometimes I feel that side doesn't really get looked upon. And when I read your story, I felt that recognized as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as I say, I was a child, and having to deal with this at school. I mean, I don't have the most vivid memories of my mother, because she died when I was quite young. But some of the things that stayed with me would be the perception of someone who's admitted in a psychiatric hospital, you know, and as a child, having to explain that to a teacher, having to explain that to my friends, you know, it was the most difficult thing, because it was sort of almost accepted that many children with single parents would be living with their mothers.
Yeah.
Right. So with me, I had a single parent, but it was the father.
Yeah.
And you know, I always had to explain, where is your mother? And to such an extent that when she died, it seemed easier to explain that she is no more.
Yeah.
Than when I had to explain that she is admitted in a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah, it's a very difficult thing to handle, especially for a child. And part of the reason I wrote the story, for me, it was to deal with my own emotions, because for a long time I couldn't talk about my mother. I couldn't see how she died and what she was going through, you know. And there was also an element of being ashamed at some point.
Yes.
Of the fact that my mother is mentally ill, you know. And I write now because I'm ashamed of the fact that I was ashamed of my own mother's illness, as if she had created it herself.
You know? Yeah. Yep. I understand what you say, and thank you for sharing this and telling and for writing the story. You are teaching at the Department of English in UJ. I'm really interested in, what do you teach? How does a day look like? What are the courses? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
In 2022, I joined the University of Johannesburg as a lecturer in the English department. Well, it was a return to academia for me after 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually worked for national government for 18 years.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the fascinating things when I joined UJ, actually the first full year that I had to teach was 2023. We had just gotten out of the COVID period, and I discovered that one of my colleagues was actually teaching my story, The Suit Continued, with The Suit, you know, and naturally he just handed over to me. So at first year level, and so I introduced the series of The Suit stories.
Yes.
And the students find them quite fascinating.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yes.
Yeah. So I teach The Suit, The Suit Continued, and The Dress That Fed The Suit. So, which is quite easy when you have to teach, for instance, point of view.
Yes.
Characterization.
Yes.
You know, and generally a short story structure.
Yes.
So it's one of the favorite courses for the students.
Mm-hmm.
But I also teach colonial and post-colonial literature, which is what I studied.
Okay.
And again, what I try to do, for instance, I study a lot of Chinua Achebe and Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Wole Soyinka.
Yes, I never know how to pronounce his name.
Okay. Yeah, well, you have to revisit this podcast.
Yes,
to get there.
I will. Yes.
Yeah. So what I do, I try to mix them up with newer writings.
Yes.
Like at postgraduate level, for instance, I teach Zexim Das, The Zulus of New York.
Okay, yeah.
Which is based in the 1800s, around 1884. And you'd remember that 1884, 1885 is the period of formal colonialism.
Yeah.
And then Ngugi is a grain of wheat. it's about the transition, you know, when Kenya gained independence in the 1960s.
Yeah.
1963, to be specific. And Nova Lead Bulawayo's Glory, which gives history of Zimbabwe, particularly the post-independence history. So it's quite fascinating to look at those three texts.
Yeah.
You know, dealing with more or less the same issues from different periods. And so I teach, you know, contemporary literature. I teach literature of the diaspora. I've taught a lot of Langston Hughes, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Comes back to me. It was a very long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and my interest in, actually, I have a book coming out in February 2026. Yeah. Which is an edited volume. My chapter there, it's about Block Motisane, who's also from the Sophiatown generation.
Yeah.
But my chapter looks into the relationship between Langston Hughes and Block Motisane. They exchanged over 50 letters between 1960 and 1967. And I wrote a play around that called Block and His American Bantu. And again, I mean, when I was asking you about possibilities of translating some South African works to Dutch, it's about, you know, transnational connections that you find. So that's what I write about in this play and in this chapter, to say culturally, how does the US connect with South Africa? Are there personalities that we could use to illustrate this cultural connection?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's very interesting. So we have to keep an eye on the book that's coming out in February.
Yes, it's called Bloke of All Ages.
Bloke of All Ages. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to remember that and look out for it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You'll know about it.
Thank you. Then, finally, I'm also curious to hear, what does your role as chair of the Sunday Times look like? For example, how do you select the shortlist nominees, and what qualities does a winning story need to provide in South Africa in 2025?
Well, it's one of the most demanding and difficult tasks that I've embarked upon. Being the chair of the Sunday Times Literary Awards. It's probably South Africa's premier literary awards. I've been following the awards for over 20 years.
Yeah.
So it's a great honor to be chosen as the chair of the fiction panel. Fortunately, they give us a guideline.
Yes.
You know, if I may read it, the guide says, the winner should be a novel of rare imagination and style, evocative, textured, and a tale so compelling as to become an enduring landmark of contemporary fiction. Generally, it's difficult to find a text that possesses all these qualities at equal measure. So you go through over 20 books. Fortunately for us, what Sunday Times does, because they receive about 100 or so submissions, and then they did the preliminary, selection.
Yes.
And give us the long list of about 25 or so.
Yes.
And those 25 are usually some of the best texts you find, published that year.
Yeah.
So that's where the difficult task begins. And to reach the five and ultimately the winner, is usually the most difficult thing. But quite interestingly, this year, all the three judges had, you know, there was no tussling about the top five.
Yeah. So there was no question about the top five.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because what happens is we individually do our scores.
Yes.
And select what we think individually should be, you know, are some of the best works. And all the three judges this time around, the highest scoring texts were ultimately the ones that you find in the shortlist. Yeah. And as I say, we worked independently, but somehow our scores were the same, more or less the same, I would say. So, because you usually score out of 10.
Okay.
Yeah. So they were.
What is the 10? Is that language, imagination, character, plot?
Yes. So the elements that are listed here.
Yeah.
If you feel that, for instance, the language may be good, but the storyline is not so compelling.
Yeah.
Then you say reduce.
Yes.
You know, and then so.
And do you do that totally independent from each other?
Yeah, we do that independently, and then we meet and share our scores.
Okay.
So that's what I found most fascinating this year. That.
Where did you meet?
At the Sunday Times offices.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We meet. There we have at least two meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we finally met, shared our scores, they were more or less the same, and the highest scoring texts for each one of us were the same texts that ultimately we shortlisted. Yeah.
And where will it be announced?
I don't know the venue, but I will share the details with you.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
And then is there consensus?
Yes, there is consensus.
Yeah. Big winner, clear winner?
There's a clear winner.
Okay.
There's a clear winner. Again, all three judges. Much as it was difficult, because for us, I mean, the five are really powerful.
Yeah.
Any of those texts could be a winner. But we had to find the ultimate winner. And interestingly, again, the winner that each one of us selected was the same text.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it doesn't always happen like that. Usually judges are always at each other's throats. Fortunately, this was quite easy to decide. Yeah.
Okay, I'm very curious. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
That's very exciting. I'd like to finish with an obvious but fun question. With the long South African summer holidays coming up, is there a book, apart from the award nominees, that you'd recommend we read during the festive season?
Oh, honestly, I have a long list of books to read myself. And, you know, because I was giant Sunday Times, I didn't read too much fun reading.
Yes.
But on my bedside right now is a nonfiction book, Under Smart as a Rule. By Bongani Ngulunga. It's about Jan Smuts's interaction with black leaders during his tenure.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading that one. I've been tempted, so I kept reading parts of it, and I found it quite fascinating.
Okay, thank you. Sipiwo, thank you so much for this conversation, for your insights, your energy, your knowledge, and for sharing your time with us. I'm truly grateful for your input.
Thank you. I'm grateful. It was wonderful to be here.
Thank you. To my listeners, I wish you a joyful and warm holiday season, full of good moments with family and friends. And of course, I hope your shelves at home, or if you're traveling, your travel bags are full of books waiting to be read. I hope this conversation inspires you to make sure you read even more. This was my last podcast of 2025. I hope you've enjoyed it and that it motivates you to read and talk about books. I look forward to welcoming you back next year for more stories, conversations, and literary delights.